Thank you for downloading this Council on Foreign Relations podcast. CFR is an independent national membership organization and nonpartisan research center. For more information, please visit us online at cfr.org.
Good afternoon from New York and welcome to the Council on Foreign Relations, Religion and Foreign Policy conference call series. I'm Irina Faskanis, Vice President for the National Program and Outreach here at CFR. As a reminder, today's call is on the record, and the audio will be available on our website, www.cfr.org. We're delighted to have Reza Aslan with us today to talk about Iran, the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, and what is happening in the region. Dr. Aslan is CFR's Adjunct Senior Fellow and is the Wallerstein Visiting Professor at Drew University. He's on sabbatical from the University of California, Riverside, and has taught previously at the University of Iowa. He's a best-selling author and a scholar of religions. His first book, God But God, The Origins, Evolution, and Future of Islam, was an international bestseller and was named one of the 100 most important books of the last decade. Reza, thanks very much for being with us today, as I highlighted. It would be terrific if you could give us an overview of Iran's role in the Israeli-Palestinian conflict as you see it, and talk a little bit about its relationship with Hamas and the situation in the region.
Thank you, Irina. Thank you, everyone, for joining us for this conversation. As Irina said, we're going to talk about Iran, its role in the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, and its relationship with Hamas. This is obviously a fairly large topic of conversation, so I'm going to keep my initial comments fairly brief, about 10 minutes or so, to ensure that we have plenty of time for questions, which I'm sure will run the gambit. Well, as usual with CFR conversations when it comes to global affairs, particularly in the Middle East, this is one of those on the one hand, on the other hand scenarios. So let's start with on the one hand. Iran, it's true, sees Hamas and also Hezbollah in Lebanon as a proxy force, as a hedge against the possibility of an Israeli attack. I think it's important to understand that Iran really is no match for Israel when it comes to an open war. Iranian weapons are nowhere near the sophistication of Israel's American-made mostly weapons. But the idea for Iran is that with Hamas and Hezbollah as a kind of proxy force, Israel may think twice about an open confrontation with Iran, especially if that means that it would have to end up fighting it on three separate fronts. So on that sense, very true that from Iran's point of view, they see Hamas as a proxy force in its conflict with Israel. It's also true that really since the late 1980s, about 10%, well, actually, in the 1980s, it was about 10% of Hamas's funding, which came from Iran. And later on, it became much more so, certainly in the 90s and the early 2000s. By some estimates, Iran provided Hamas with about $30 million a year. More recently, and certainly since the 2006 elections, which ended up essentially closing off Hamas-run Gaza from the rest of the world, Iran has stepped up and significantly increased its funding by some estimates to what could be hundreds of millions of dollars. Now, that's a lot of money. So there is a lot of funding from the Islamic Republic of Iran coming to Hamas, but I do think that it is important to kind of put that in perspective. I mean, far, far more cash has come to Hamas from Sunni Arab countries, particularly Saudi Arabia, than it has from Iran. But nonetheless, Iran is a major funder of Hamas. Another thing to keep in mind, and this was certainly on the news during the recent conflict between Israel and Gaza, is that Iran has been providing Hamas with, and this is where we're a little bit unclear, either weapons or weapons technology. It depends who you ask. Nevertheless, the larger point is that the success that Hamas has had with some of its newer rockets is quite obviously and openly a result of Iranian assistance. As a matter of fact, not too recently, the commander of Iran's Revolutionary Guard, a man, by the name of Mohammad Jafari, openly admitted that his forces supplied Hamas with what he called the know-how to develop the Fajr 5 missiles. These were the missiles that Hamas launched against Tel Aviv. Now, according to Mohammad Jafari, Iran didn't actually give Hamas weapons per se, but it gave them, as he put it, the technological know-how to make them the weapons. So when you put these three together, that Iran sees Hamas as a proxy force, that it has given Hamas hundreds of millions of dollars over the last two or three decades, and that it openly acknowledges providing Hamas with either weapons or weapons technology, it becomes very clear that the relationship between Iran and Hamas is quite a strong one. The question, however, is, and I guess this is where we get to the other, on the other hand, does this mean necessarily that Hamas is a puppet of the Iranian regime? And I use this phrase deliberately because it's a phrase that's used quite often in the media conversation about the relationship between Hamas and Iran. Certainly, this is something that Prime Minister Netanyahu made a very big deal about during the conflict. In fact, he has gone on record as saying that Hamas has created, quote, an Iranian base in Gaza. And certainly, if you remember the sort of media narrative about the war between Gaza and Israel, many commentators referred to it as a kind of practice war with Iran, as though this was, prepping the ground for a war with Iran by eliminating Hamas from the equation. The New York Times did a very large piece about this, in which it said that part of the war gaming that Israel has been doing with regard to cutting off Iran's nuclear program has been to deal with what it calls Iran's surrogate, Hamas, Hezbollah, also Islamic Jihad, by striking them first. So the question is not so much, is there a relationship between Iran and Hamas? That seems pretty clear. The question that I would like to focus on is, how close is that relationship, and does it actually translate into Hamas as a, quote, puppet of the Iranian regime? And I think that there is reason to question that assumption. And there's a couple of reasons for this. First of all, we have to understand that the Hamas-Iran ties, at least historically, have been intimately connected to Hamas-Syria ties. Of course, as many of you know, Hamas, until very recently, had its main base outside of Gaza, certainly, in Damascus. It saw the regime of Bashar al-Assad as its primary supporter, and certainly Syria is a close ally of Iran, and that relationship allowed for a real flourishing of relations between Iran and Hamas. But again, as most of you probably know, Hamas ended its relationship with the Syrian regime earlier this year as a result of the civil war taking place in Syria. And in fact, it moved its headquarters out of Syria. And that move, and by the way, the way in which Hamas has come out quite strongly speaking out against the human rights abuses of the Assad regime, has not only strained relations between Hamas and Syria, obviously, but it's strained relations between Hamas and Iran. And in fact, I would go so far as to say that it has fundamentally altered those relationships. It's really driven a wedge, if you will, this conflict in Syria between Hamas and Iran. In fact, there are reports now that the Hamas offices in Tehran have been shut down as a punishment for the Hamas's stance on Syria. So, in other words, I think in many ways, when it comes to Iranian support for Hamas, it appears to be, as one foreign policy analyst put it, more theatrical than practical. In fact, even when it comes to this conflict that we saw a few weeks ago, apart from supplying the technology for those weapons, I think most analysts would say that Iran didn't have any overt influence over the way in which Hamas fought this war with Israel. And in other words, Hamas certainly didn't act as though it was Iran's proxy. Otherwise, frankly, I'm not sure if it would have agreed to a ceasefire. On the contrary, if it was doing Iran's bidding, if Hamas truly was Iran's puppet, it seems clear that it would have probably done everything in its power to force Israel to launch a land invasion in Gaza. That would have been truly for Iran's benefit. And in fact, I think it's important to understand that Hamas was severely criticized in the Iranian press for accepting the ceasefire. There was an editorial in a conservative newspaper in Iran, Jumhuriya Islami, which is tied to the supreme leader, that was titled, "Is Hamas Changing Its Skin?" And in fact, it was a scathing criticism of Hamas and its purported complacency in the face of what it sees as is Israel's violations of the ceasefire. And the fact that Hamas, as far as this editorial was concerned, had effectively recognized Israeli sovereignty by accepting this ceasefire. And the final thing that I would just like to add as before we start the conversation is that what's happened over the last few months, over the last 6-7 months, certainly since the break between Hamas and Syria, is that other Sunni Arab countries have really risen to the fore and have begun to support Hamas, particularly with money. I'm speaking specifically, of course, of Qatar, which is now bankrolling Hamas to the tune of about $400 million. And also in a slightly different way by Egypt, which certainly under President Morsi is far closer to Hamas than it was under Hosni Mubarak. The result of this, I think, is twofold. Qatar and Egypt, of course, are countries that have international legitimacy and close relations with the United States. If these two countries become Hamas's closest supporters, then it seems as though the path is being laid for the international acceptance of Hamas as, if not the legitimate government of Gaza, then at least certainly a necessary voice in any kind of negotiation, either among the Palestinians or between the Palestinians and Israel. And I suppose from an American perspective, an argument could be made that we would far prefer a relationship between countries like Qatar and Egypt, countries that America has influence over, countries like that with Hamas, than certainly countries like Syria and Iran. And in fact, a number of my colleagues have said that this realignment in between Hamas and these Sunni Arab American allies is a good thing and should be fostered as a way, not just, as I say, of perhaps figuring out a way to bring Hamas into the fold, but to actually continue to isolate Iran and to isolate Syria, which are, after all, at this point, America's most intractable enemy in the region. So I will stop my opening comments there, and we'll just open it up, and I'm sure that there are plenty of questions, either about what I've spoken about or about something that I did not mention. I'm happy to sort of carry this conversation wherever you would like it to go.
Excellent. Thanks so much, Reza. Let's open up for questions and comments from the group.
Thank you. At this time, we'll open up for questions. If you would like to ask a question, you can do so by pressing star 1 on your touchtone phone. Questions will be taken in the order in which they are received. If at any time you would like to remove yourself from the question queue, press star 2. Again, to ask a question, press star 1. Our first question comes from Dr. Shel Ubert.
Is this Sheikh Ubaid, you said?
Yes, go ahead, Sheikh.
Yeah, thanks for taking my call. My question, very interesting presentation. Is the relationship that between Iran and Hamas, is it more strategic or more ideological? I am asking that question because Iran had lost almost all its goodwill that it had generated among the Sunni Muslims, who are the majority, when it supported Bashar al-Assad of Syria. Even though the Islamists who would have come to power after Bashar would still have been closer to Iran than not. But Iran went because of ideological reasons, because of Shia theology. So will Iran and Hamas future relationship, is it a more permanent one, or will it be damaged by Iran's support to Syria?
That's a very good question. The relationship between Iran and Hamas is certainly ideological insofar as they are both adamantly against the existence of the Israeli state. And in fact, Iran burnishes its Islamic credentials, particularly in the Middle East, by sort of referring to itself as the biggest supporters of the Palestinian cause. And certainly that is an argument that carries a great deal of water on the Arab street. After all, with the exception of Syria, most of Israel's traditional enemies are either at peace with it or at least in a state of non-confrontation. And Iran sees itself as kind of picking up the slack. Despite the fact that it is a Shia nation, it tries to appeal to the Sunni Arab street by opposing Israel, by maintaining its ideological stance against Israel. And certainly that ideology connects it to Hamas. The relationship is also strategic for the reasons that I had explained. Iran really does see Hamas as a hedge against open conflict with Israel. It truly believes, whether this is a legitimate belief or not, but it truly believes that the thing that's keeping Israel from launching its missiles at Iran is not an Iranian retaliation, which, frankly, Israel could handle. Israel is by far the stronger nation in this conflict, but the possibility of an asymmetrical warfare on its flank, both on its western flank and its northern flank. So the strategic and the ideological aspects are pretty obvious there in many ways. But to your larger question about whether this is a long-term relationship, I don't think so. I think that it is truly a marriage of convenience. Hamas, of course, relies on its power precisely because of the image that it projects as the legitimate opposition to Israeli aggression. And its support on the Arab street cannot be seen to be compromised by its association with either Iran or the Assad regime. So that's why it sort of removed itself from Syria, because the relationship with Assad was damaging to Hamas's the projection that Hamas wants to present. With regard to Iran, Hamas recognizes that as a Shia nation, that there are a lot of Sunni Arabs that look at Iran as an enemy. And so it, as opposed to Iran, which likes to make a lot of noise about its support for Hamas, you don't see the same coming from Hamas. You don't see Hamas leaders constantly touting Iran and Iranian support, Iranian weapons, Iranian money. Certainly they appreciate it. It comes in useful, no doubt, but they want to sort of keep that, fairly quiet because it does have the potential of damaging the image that they want to project in the region. So I think truly what we're talking about here for both sides is a marriage of convenience more than anything else.
Can I ask a follow-up question to that?
Quickly,
Sheikh,
then we'll move on.
Yep. The relationship between Hamas and Iran, you said, was linked through Syria. But is it not dependent more rather than with Syria more than a relationship between Muslim Brotherhood and Iran? Because Syria, when it was oppressing the Muslim Brotherhood during Assad's father, Hamas and Ikhwan still had a relationship with Iran. So is it more a relationship between the Muslim Brotherhood and Iran which determines, or is it between Syria and Hamas?
I think what you're asking is the what I mentioned as kind of the glue that held Hamas and Iran's relationship together being Syria, and in your question is it Syria or is it the Muslim Brotherhood? I'm not exactly sure how to answer that question. I mean, what I can say is that Iran's ties to Muslim Brotherhood causes, be it in Syria or in Egypt or anywhere else, is tenuous at best. I mean, Iran certainly does not have a relationship with the Muslim Brotherhood in Syria because the Muslim Brotherhood in Syria is, for the most part, anti-Assad. Iran's relationship with Syria is based on its relationship with Assad. So I'll stick with my initial assessment in saying that that it's truly Assad and the regime in Syria that acted as the glue that bound Hamas and Iran together. And now that glue is gone, the relationship between Hamas and Iran, I don't think, is nearly as intimate as it was in the past.
Thank you. Next question.
Thank you. Our next question comes from John Bryson Chain with the Episcopal Church.
Thank you very much. Dr. Eshwan, thank you for your presentation today. As one who spent a great deal of time in Iran over the last 5 years, your analysis is very helpful to me. I wanted to talk to you and see if you could answer or have any wisdom on the issue pertaining to the ongoing nuclear talks with Iran, and especially given the fact that the Supreme Leader has made it clear on several fatwas issued that the development of nuclear weapons is contrary to the teachings of the Prophet Muhammad and of the Quran, and Iran is permitted to enrich up to 20%. So the question to you is, how do you interpret what the leader says, given the fact that the leader literally is both the senior religious cleric in the country and is the one who makes ultimately the decisions in that country with lots of input? That's number one. Number two, how do you see the ability of the United States government to understand what the leader is saying in these very complex talks that seem to be going nowhere?
Thank you. That's a very important question. You're absolutely right. As has been repeatedly noted, the Supreme Leader, Ayatollah Khamenei, and in fact the previous Supreme Leader, Ayatollah Khomeini, have both on numerous occasions issued religious decrees outlawing the use of nuclear weapons as being anathema to Islam. And I think that many people make the argument that as a result of those fatwas, Iran would not develop a nuclear weapon because it would be in violation of what their own supreme leaders had said. I want to be a little bit skeptical about that line for not the reason that you probably think, but because we have a tendency when we think of Iran, the Islamic Republic of Iran, which in the eyes of many Americans is a theocratic regime that is run by religious fiat and whose sole concern is the maintaining of religious ideology. That view of Iran is fundamentally flawed. It's flawed on both sides. In other words, when you hear people like the Prime Minister of Israel say that Iran is a country run by religious fanatics and that as a result, they do not function the way other countries function, that an Iran with nuclear weapons would use those nuclear weapons, could not be deterred from using it based on mutually assured destruction, that on the contrary, it would use those nuclear weapons in a form of kind of collective suicide because of its religious zeal. In other words, the argument is that Iran's military strategy, indeed its foreign policy, is dictated by its religious beliefs. On the other hand, there is exactly what you were saying, which is that, well, if Iran is dictated by its religious beliefs categorically outlaw and completely prohibit the use of such weapons of mass destruction. The problem is that both of those arguments are actually flawed because the assumption that it is religion or religious ideology that drives Iranian foreign or domestic policy is wrong. That's a fundamentally flawed assumption. Iran functions the way every other nation on earth functions. It pursues its national interests above all else. Indeed, quite famously, Ayatollah Khomeini said that the pursuit of Iran's national interests is a higher pursuit than its Islamic interests. The thing is that certainly Iran uses religious ideology to justify and legitimize itself, whether that works or not, I think is an argument to be had. But it doesn't make strategic military or foreign policy decisions based on religion. It makes it based on its own interests. Iran supports Hamas not for religious reasons, but in its own self-interest. It sees its support for Hamas as serving its national security interests. Everything that Iran does on the international and domestic stage is predicated on the pursuit of its own interests. So I think that's an important thing to keep in mind. Now, I don't by any means want to say that this means that Iran is developing nuclear weapons or that it isn't developing nuclear weapons. I just think that question should be divorced from Iran's religious ideology. Now, the much more complicated question about negotiations and where we are, and I think you're right, we are at a standstill here. What's ironic about those negotiations is that the parameters for moving forward are pretty well known to everyone. And indeed, they have been, at least in principle, accepted by both sides, both the P5 plus one, the five permanent members of the Security Council and Germany, and by the Iranian side. And more or less what it amounts to is this, that there has to be a public and pronounced declaration by the P5 plus one of Iran's right to enrich uranium under the protocols of the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty in exchange for greater observation of its nuclear sites. And I think at this point it's important for everyone to understand that Iran's centrifuges are all under direct IAEA observation and control. These centrifuges have actual IAEA tags on them. So we are monitoring Iran's centrifuges. Now, some would say, well, the ones that we know of, and that's a perfectly legitimate argument, there very well may be sites in Iran that we are unaware of. But nevertheless, I sometimes people make it sound as though Iran is just sort of churning ahead with its centrifuges without any kind of outside involvement, and that's certainly not the case. But with regard to Iran's ability to enrich uranium, Iran has said that it's willing to enrich uranium domestically at either 3.5% or 5%, that it is willing to ship the spent fuel to an outside country, either Russia or perhaps somewhere in the Gulf, where it can be enriched to 20% for its medical isotopes. Iran is currently doing that on its own. But in exchange, Iran wants to have a larger conversation, what it calls the grand bargain, not just about its nuclear program, but about everything, about sanctions, about its international isolation. And that's something that, to be perfectly frank, the Obama administration thus far has not been willing to engage in. There hasn't really been a serious attempt on the part of the Obama administration to lay out a firm timeline, a firm outline, a document that says to Iran what it gets in return for its capitulation. in its nuclear program, when, you know, certain banking restrictions would be removed, when would restrictions on its oil infrastructure be removed, when would just sanctions in itself be removed. The United States, for a whole host of reasons, wants these conversations to focus like a laser on the nuclear issue. Iran is adamant that in order to talk about the nuclear issue, the entire sort of grand bargain strategy has to be put on the table. And that's right now where we're kind of at loggerheads. Now, I do think that with the election in the United States having, you know, come and gone, the Obama administration is in a better place to negotiate, to actually be able to offer Iran the things that it requires, including, as I say, that robust statement of its right to enrich uranium under the protocols of the Nuclear Nonproliferation Treaty, without having the sort of the political cost that would come with that kind of statement. So I think that we are probably going to see further movement on negotiations come January. But, you know, we've said this before, and it remains to be seen.
Thank you. Next question.
Thank you. As a reminder, to ask a question, you can do so by pressing star 1. Our next question comes from Ram Daslam from the University of Hawaii.
Yes. Okay, first of all, thank you for this wonderful talk. And very enlightening. I kind of have two questions. From my understanding, countries like Saudi Arabia don't really want Iran to become nuclear. So if this is true, then is not Saudi Arabia's support for Hamas actually benefiting Iran in what you have just discussed and maybe helping to deflect some of the attention away from Iran and Israel's attention towards Hamas, and therefore giving it more of an option to develop its weapons? And then the second question is, doesn't the issue of taqiya or lying become relevant in the, anything the Supreme Ayatollah says about nuclear issues? Thank you.
Well, let me start with the first question. It is certainly true that Iran and Saudi Arabia are by no means friends, that they have been sort of in a state of cold war for the last 30 years. Saudi Arabia, of course, sees itself as the representative of the Sunni Muslim world. Iran sees itself as the representative of the Shia Muslim world. In certain fields, like in Bahrain, they have been pretty openly in conflict with each other, with the Iranians supporting the Shia in Bahrain and the Saudis supporting the Bahrain monarchy with tanks and weapons. As a matter of fact, it was Saudi troops that fired on protesters in Bahrain. And it is certainly the case that an Iran with nuclear weapons would be seen as much as a threat in Saudi Arabia as it would be in Israel. Saudi Arabia has very close relationships with the United States, and it has been trying desperately to get the United States. In fact, it's been pretty much toe-to-toe with Israel in trying to push the United States into an open conflict, a military conflict, in order to deal with Iran's nuclear ambition. Now, that Cold War between Iran and Saudi Arabia has, of course, a whole host of geopolitical ramifications that are beyond this particular conversation. But you are right to say that Saudi support for Hamas can be seen as somewhat undermining Iran. This goes back to kind of what I was saying before, is that if Hamas is getting its primary funding from American allies, then that would naturally open the door to greater American influence in what's happening in Gaza. On the flip side to that, of course, is that, you know, the problem is that unless that support leads to a kind of a path opening up for Hamas to become part of the larger conversation in the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, then, you know, it's not really going to go anywhere. I mean, this this perhaps is part of a larger conversation, and someone else will ultimately ask this question, but the issue at hand right now, post the conflict that we saw a few weeks ago in Gaza, is that Hamas is here to stay, and that there has to be some mechanism whereby it can be integrated into the discussion between Israel and the Palestinians, between the United States and the Palestinians, in trying to create some semblance of a two-state solution and a path to peaceful negotiation in the Middle East. Now, let me answer your second question. And what I want to say, what the gentleman was bringing up is this idea called Takiyah, which is an ancient, medieval, and absolutely unknown and unpracticed concept within Shia Islam, called, that is best translated as dissimulation. The Shia have always been a persecuted minority in the Muslim world. Today, they make up about 15% of the world's 1.5 billion Muslims. But for much of the great vast Arab and Islamic empires in Islamic history, to be a Shia was to be a target of repression and even death. Shia were seen as heretics. And so a theory developed called Takiyah, whereby a Shia who can sort of deny that he's a Shia, he can deny his faith and say that he's not a Shia in order to save his life. Now, over the last decade or so, as a result of this kind of rampant Islamophobia industry that has absolutely gripped the United States, this medieval concept of dissimulation, of being able to deny your faith in order to save your life, has been falsely translated as lying. And you've heard over and over again these sort of Islamophobic avatars like Robert Spencer and Pamela Geller and David Yerushalmi say that, well, you can't really trust anything that any Muslim says because it's all Takiyah. It's all that they're allowed to lie. This is utter nonsense. It's ridiculous. It's absurd. Please get it out of your mind immediately.
Thank you. Next question.
Thank you. As a reminder, to ask a question, press star 1. Our next question comes from John Polakowski from Catholic Theological Union.
Yes, good afternoon. On the hypothetical possibility that Mr. Obama, after January, as you suggested, might successfully come to an agreement with Iran, if that were to occur, would you see Iran playing any kind of constructive role in terms of Gaza and the settlement of the Israeli-Palestinian situation?
Thank you for that question. Well, frankly, the most constructive role that Iran could play in the Israeli-Palestinian conflict is to just simply butt out. And in fact, that is sort of the argument behind both those who say that the best way to deal with Iran is to deal with the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, to create a stable, economically viable Palestinian state that sits side by side with a safe and secure Israel. Because that takes away, as I was saying before, Iran's sort of biggest propaganda card and continues to isolate Iran in the region. And then on the flip side, those who say, well, no, the way to deal with, you know, moving forward on a Israeli-Palestinian negotiation, again, this is the argument of the Prime Minister of Israel, Benjamin Netanyahu, is first deal with Iran. Take Iran out of the equation. And then you're in a better place to deal with the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. Just to be clear, my personal opinion is much more with the former. I think that, you know, if you really want to take Iran out of the equation, then you know, deal with the Israeli-Palestinian conflict first and make Iran irrelevant. But I do think that you're right in the sense that dealing with Iran's nuclear ambition, taking that off the table, can provide an enormous amount of impetus, not just for the Israeli-Palestinian negotiations, but frankly, for America's larger interests in the region. For instance, when it comes to Syria. Currently, I mean, besides the fact that Syria gets, you know, some 70% of its arms shipments from Russia, really, right now, Iran is Syria's only friend. If we could begin to distance Iran from Syria, that would increase pressure on Assad. That's good for America. Currently, you know, weaponization, this movement of weapons technology from Iran to Hamas, if we could put an end to that, that would also support America's national security interests. So there's a whole host of things that kind of instantly fall into place if we can get this kind of nuclear boogeyman out of the way. And certainly the one important thing to keep in mind is that Iran currently, as it stands, it is in a very fractured state. Despite the sort of confident blustering that we often hear from Iranian officials, whether Ahmadinejad or Khamenei, the truth of the matter is that the Iranian regime is more fractured today than it has ever been in the last 30 years. The economy, of course, is on the verge of total collapse. The rial has seen the kind of inflation that in most countries would result in civil war, in just, you know, absolute chaos. At the same time, you have a legislature, the parliament in Iran, which has tried to impeach the president three separate times over the last year, a president in Iran that has openly wondered about the usefulness of the clerical regime. In fact, Ahmadinejad quite famously said last year that the governance of the Islamic Republic is too complicated a thing to be put into the hands of the mullahs, which is kind of an interesting statement considering that's the entire foundation of the Islamic Republic that he is the president of. And then, of course, lately we've had Khamenei, the supreme leader, make certain comments in the press about whether Iran even needs a president or not. This is a country that is falling apart at the seams. Currently, the one thing that's keeping Iran together, the thing that sort of is keeping the government together, and that frankly is keeping the people in support of the government, is this threat of an external attack. The idea that any moment now, either Israel or the United States is going to start bombing Iran. Iran, as many of you know, is a fiercely prideful nation. Regardless of how they may feel about their own government, Iranians will not abide by external influence or by a military attack. They will rally to their government the way that they did in the 1980s in the eight-year-long Iran-Iraq war. So if it is true, and I do think that it is, as an expert in Iran, if it is true that the thing that's kind of keeping that country together, keeping it from falling apart, is this threat of a military invasion, well, the best thing that we could do in the United States, if we truly want to see regime change in Iran, if we want to see transformation take place in that country, is to figure out a way to get that military invasion threat off the table. And negotiations, of course, is the best way to do that. All of this is to say that the benefits of negotiating our way out of this Iran mess are enormous. And I, for one, really hope that the president takes advantage of this opportunity and does so.
Thank you. Next question.
Thank you. Our next question comes from Satpal Singh from World Think Council.
For taking my question. I just wanted to know if there is any reasonable scenario where the United States can exert any meaningful influence on Hamas through Qatar and Egypt or maybe even Saudi Arabia to reach some solution in the region?
A very important question. I mean, on the one hand, the United States is forbidden by congressional law to actually negotiate directly with Hamas. This is one of those times in which laws that are often passed for nothing more than just some kind of political gain by the Congress actually is detrimental to America's national and foreign policy interests. After all, Israel has far more reason to hate Hamas than the United States does, and yet Israel regularly negotiates with Hamas. In fact, Israel is in fairly constant communication with Hamas leaders. And this goes to, you know, a statement that, you know, the great Moshe Dayan once said, which is that you negotiate with your enemies, not your friends. And so unless the United States is willing to take Hamas seriously as the representative of the Palestinian people in Gaza, it becomes very difficult for us to influence the region to our own benefit. Now, as I was saying before, I think that there's going to be a concerted effort by the Obama administration to use its close ties with Qatar and with Egypt in order to influence Hamas. We saw this, by the way, in the ceasefire that put an end to the hostilities a couple of weeks ago. It was with the help of Secretary of State Clinton and, of course, President Obama, who was on the phone with the Egyptian President Mohamed Morsi. It was that sort of triangle that ultimately resulted in the parameters that led to the peace process. That led to the ceasefire. So already we're seeing the results of that. We're seeing the United States try to use intermediaries in order to communicate and indeed influence Hamas. But if we really want to have influence, I think that we're going to have to figure out a way to realize what Israel has already realized, which is, as I say, if you're not willing to talk to your enemies, they will always remain your enemy.
Next question, please.
Thank you. Our next question comes from Simi Ahmed from Muslim Peace Coalition.
Thank you, Dr. Aslan, for a wonderful presentation, especially for exposing the Islamophobia that's rampant today. I was wondering, you know, Iran has said repeatedly that it wouldn't come in between Israel and Palestine. If the Middle East, do you think if the Middle East were made nuclear free, that Israel and Iran would make peace one day?
Well, you know, as an advocate of nuclear nonproliferation and as a 10-year member of the Board of Advisors for the Plowshares Fund, which is America's largest grant-making organization dealing specifically with nuclear nonproliferation, I am a wholehearted advocate of a nuclear-free Middle East. I do think it's important to understand that when Iran makes that comment, when it talks about a nuclear-free Middle East, it's doing so mostly for political gain, of course. What it wants to highlight is that there is a nuclear power in the Middle East that is has not signed on to the Nuclear Nonproliferation Treaty or any of its accompanying protocols, and that's Israel. And that, despite the fact that the IAEA is calling for Iran to abide by the additional protocols of the NPT that it signed, which, is, by the way, it has not, Iran says, no, but the IAEA hasn't even bothered to investigate Israel's nuclear arsenal. So it sort of sees a double standard, if you will, between the way that the West and the IAEA and the UN deal with Iran's burgeoning nuclear program and the way that it deals with the reality of Israel's nuclear weapons program. So that part, I think, is absolutely true. I do think, however, that this larger argument about the use of nuclear weapons, you know, President Obama, in the first foreign policy speech that he made when he was elected in 2008, called for a world free of nuclear weapons. And he made a statement that I think should really stick in the claw of everybody, every one of us in the world, which is that we are fast approaching a time in which the growth of technology has made it so that either soon everyone is going to have nuclear weapons or no one will have nuclear weapons. Those are the two choices that are before us right now. The Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, as much of an advocate of it as I am, is fundamentally flawed. It's fundamentally flawed, first, because it says that five countries are allowed to have nuclear weapons and nobody else is. It's fundamentally flawed because it is routinely violated by its signatories, for instance, the United States, despite the fact that Article 1 of the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, the very first paragraph in the treaty that we ourselves wrote, says no signatory of this treaty can engage in nuclear trade with a nuclear weapon state that is not a signatory of this treaty. But despite that, we are engaging in nuclear trade with India, in fact, helping them expand their nuclear weapons arsenal. And it's fundamentally flawed for a third reason, which is that it actually hasn't stopped countries from developing nuclear weapons, be it Israel or India or Pakistan or North Korea, and perhaps one day even Iran. So we do need greater international safeguards, and we do need a reexamination of the fundamental treaties that are meant to actually stop the proliferation of nuclear weapons. But, you know, to your larger question, I mean, I'm an advocate of a nuclear-free world, not just a nuclear-free Middle East.
Thank you. Other questions?
Thank you. There are no further questions at this time.
Thank you very much, everyone. I truly appreciate it. I appreciate all your questions, and I'm very easy to reach via the CFR website. Thank you very much.
Okay, Reza, thank you. Thank you very much for taking the time to lead today's call. And to all of you, we appreciate your questions. I hope that you will, as Reza said, go to CFR.org and read more of his work there. This conference call series is part of our Religion and Foreign Policy Initiative, and we would welcome your feedback and suggestions on topics that we should consider more to cover in this series. Our next call will be on January 17th, and it will feature Ellen Bork, Director of Democracy and Human Rights at the Foreign Policy Initiative, on China, Tibet, and religious persecution in the region. So I hope you will join us for that call. The invitation will follow after the holidays. I hope that you all do enjoy the holidays and look forward to reconvening again in the new year.
Thank you for listening to this Council on Foreign Relations podcast. For additional audio, video, and transcripts of CFR meetings, as well as expert analysis of international news, please visit us online, cfr.org.